Campus FM presents Work in Progress, a series of seminars and symposia on understanding cultural diversity. You're about to listen to the first part of Articulating the Clandestine Experience, Literary and Refugee Voices. This seminar was part of the Work in Progress seminars.
The topic tonight is Articulating the Clandestine Experience, Literary and Refugee Voices. And the idea for tonight's session was developed last summer between myself, Paul Clow, Dr. Adrian Grima, lecturer in literature at the university and at the junior college, and some other people. The idea, basically, is to bring together creative writers in Malta with creative writers from overseas who include some refugees and people who formerly were clandestine immigrants to Malta, although their position has now apparently been regularized. So tonight we are going to have Dr. Adrian Grima speaking in perhaps half an hour's time when he arrives, and he will be arriving with the second speaker, Popol. Popol is a creative writer who was a refugee and is now head of the Congolese community in Malta. But we begin tonight with Mr. Norbert Bujeya, who is now working on his master's degree in literature at the University of Malta, and is a poet who will be giving his ideas and arguments concerning the contribution and judgments which creative writers might seek to make on the whole question of cultural diversity. And I do want to stress that tonight's session is a very open session. After Norbert speaks, we hope that Adrian Grima will have arrived with Popol. They will speak, and then there will be a very, very open interaction between all of you. And really, the discussion can go whichever way it wishes to go. Because although the theme is cultural diversity in Malta, this is also clearly an opportunity for creative writers among you, creative writers among the speakers, whether Maltese or foreign, to voice their views about the position of literature in Malta today. So please take the discussion tonight where you want to lead it. So with those few opening words, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Mr. Norbert Bujeya.
So good evening. And what follows, I will try to be as unsparing and as honest as possible. This paper, although I will be reading parts and paraphrasing other parts of it, it emerged as, well, from a main concern within the clandestine project that Initiamed is conducting right now. And tonight I shall be, well, addressing a number of questions and bringing up issues that should intrigue most of us present here. Basically, my cue for this paper is the idea that for decades, local writing has been busy honoring Predrag Matrevich's claim that Mediterranean literature is inscrutably lazy. And the clandestine project somehow brings together these local writers who are finally attempting to shake off this notorious sluggishness that has silently gathered while what I will be referring to this evening as Maltese literature slept, as it were, through the great roll of historical time. Perhaps the word that strikes me most, and that has become a buzzword even within the Initiamed jargon, is the word emergent writers. The participating writers in the clandestine multilateral project, on the clandestine website and press conferences elsewhere have been repeatedly dubbed as emergent. The title of this evening's discussion is precisely Articulating the Clandestine Experience, which is a very apt name, because it immediately highlights one of the main concerns that articulate the clandestine project itself. And the first big question that I'd like to propose this evening is, what does it mean to say that the clandestine writer, an emergent writer, is after his or her own way clandestine? So what constitutes our clandestinity? I'm saying our because I am participating in this project as well. What constitutes our clandestinity as emergent writers, writing today in 2004 Malta? In order to address this crucial question, the clandestinity that articulates our experience, we cannot but dwell for an instant on that buzzword over there, as it were, emergent. It may be a buzzword, yet for some reason we have not managed to address it. But I believe that it stands at the very core of the clandestine project. Let us not forget or even underrate for a single instant the knowledge that this project for emergent writers emerged precisely over here in Malta. So there's this need and a way that we need to take stock of the very status of the emergent writer today. But before even answering this question, we have to ask another even more basic question, which is, the aspiring writer today emerges from what? And emerges from where? I hope that this will not come across as your average, like, tired question of searching for origins, etc. Rather, this question emerges from certain outbursts that have been happening over the last couple of years from Maltese writers that we have maybe treated very lightly, but which can have very disturbing consequences on Maltese writing today. I'm referring, for instance, to Giuseppe Stanio's big statement in a recent, well, not so recent issue of Manic magazine, where he said that 98% of Maltese literature is crap. Well, I do not agree with much of what Stanio says. Amongst other things, he says that Rushdie and Garcia Marquez are wankers, for instance. But this is disturbing. No, 98% of Maltese literature is crap. I mean, I cannot imagine even the most daring of English writers, take Salman Rushdie, Daredevil, Panos Karnezis, Monica Ali, who'd say something like that about literature written in English. So the fact that this is being said about Maltese literature is certainly disturbing. Again, Claire Azzopardi here, some months ago, in an urgent need to articulate her frustration as a budding prose writer, she blurted out to me, "But Norbert, don't you feel that your poetry is somehow better than that of the Maltese writers of the past?" The disturbing thing about this is that we do not feel that these statements are unjustified. We do not feel that they are unjustified. Whereas if Rushdie would say such a thing about the English literary tradition, it would certainly sound well. But however, these are not unjustified. We can also recall last week's discussion, where Adrian Grima discussed Tahtlit Saltnit of Giuseppe Aquilina. Tahtlit Saltnit, which is considered to be a pillar of this Maltese literature. And he ventured to say that, after all, Giuseppe Aquilina is not an awful writer. And some people were shifting in their seats again. Now imagine people shifting their seats when someone says, well, Shakespeare is a good writer. Okay, it's taken to an extent for granted. I can also recall the Halfa tal-Kittiba Maltin, for instance. A number of writers who signed a declaration saying that they are prepared to fight to the death for Maltese sovereignty and against the danger of foreign rule just before we joined the EU. Even if that means the spectacular bloodbath that we have all been eagerly but vainly waiting for, and that would be wonderful to include in the Malta experience. Perhaps the single most telling fact about that Halfa, however, is that many, if not most, of its signatories' works have been canonized as Maltese literature. Another disturbing fact. Around the same period of that Halfa, another writer, who's in that other notorious canon of Maltese bestsellers, flaunted on the blurb of his recent book the blatant statement, in Maltese of course, that even though this is the work of an elderly and tired writer who has said whatever had to say, he will not relinquish his pen, inflamed by a deep-seated commitment and respect towards his readers. Okay. Another disturbing, a last disturbing thing was that of Haris Vlaviano, the clandestine writers know about him here. Haris Vlaviano, who lamented that people have to understand that Greek literature is not only made up of Homer, Kazantzakis and Kavafi, but also of a host of upcoming and emergent writers. Not only, Haris had said, yet only them allowed him to utter that statement with such unwavering confidence. Only them give the security to our Greek partners in this project to state so buoyantly on our clandestine website, the oikos of my detours in this project is this, and the Ithaca of my poem is that. Okay, I could also be forgiven my sorrow while reading into Harold Bloom's The Anxiety of Influence, where one of his central arguments there is that strong poets keep returning from the dead. Okay, this is the case with Kavafi, certainly, with W.B. Yeats and with Wallace Stevens, whom Bloom names the strongest poets of our century. So Bloom's argument is backed by an awesome tradition. And Bloom affords the luxury of stating that the covert subject of most poetry for the last three centuries has been the anxiety of influence. Each poet's fear, listen to this, each poet's fear that no proper work remains for him to perform. I know that comparisons can be odious, but please allow me to get through with mine. Our emergent poet's dreadful predicament is precisely that they do not have this anxiety that there remains no proper work for them to perform, but rather, they live with the haunting knowledge that there is so much that has never been performed. Against Tanyo's story, in Bita Kulium, the pop novella that was the Christmas bestseller of 2 years ago, the prospect of its happening now is certainly good, but the fact of its happening only now cannot but ring notes of terror for the emergent writer. Bloom argues that strong poets keep returning from the dead. But do they keep returning in Maria Greganado's poetry? Do they keep returning in Adrian Grimas and Norbert Bujeas and Stanley Board's poetry? Lo and behold, they don't. It is a predicament that clearly spells out our Orphic heritage of loneliness and abandonment. This is one important condition of our emerging status. Putting it very politely, we are the bewildered inheritors of the Keogh Betis Safar complex, the guiding star of Dunkarm, a poem that in other times and in other places has been conceived of as itself a guiding light of this construct hailed as Maltese literature. Well, conveniently, Dunkarm displaces an otherwise heterogeneous, cosmopolitan and multifaceted Maltese identification onto the realm of spiritual fantasy, myth, and the grand narratives of Catholicism and a unitary and plenary national identity. Dunkarm addresses the guiding star, stroke mother, stroke nation, describing her as the fixed point in a turning world, a stationary entity. He writes that waqt li ħutek b'sena min arħtija jisfnu madwarek bħal ġbejbit ferħana, inti bil-qeda qisekhom maqlija taħkem iż-żifna bħarsa ta' sultana. And while your sisters, with guileless skillfulness, prance around you like exultant lasses, you sit there, a prudent mother, ruling the dance with your sovereign eye. Well, the introductory phrase of the poem may very well spell out the ironic denouement of what has come to be perceived as Maltese literature. A characteristic of fixity that incorporates what Homi Bhabha would call the homogeneous empty time of the myth of the Maltese nation. In the bismat et harikš, only you never move. Okay, one of the most eloquent analyses of this discourse of fantasy as displacement of fixity is made by Jacqueline Rose, who quotes Freud. And Freud writes that fantasies are protective fictions, physical facades which bar the way to memories. This is, I believe, in essence, the complex that has come to characterize our accumulated perception of Maltese literature. The perception, fatal, I'd venture to argue, that Maltese literature matters, like Keogh Betis Safar, the impression of itself as a still point in the turning world. This is, of course, the distorting sense of security that us emergent writers have inherited. We have inherited a perception. We are emerging from a perception that this Maltese literature shares with itself, and alas, only with itself. The perception that it matters, to the exclusion of any other alternative memory to the contrary. Such has been Maltese literature's perception of itself as mattering, that in its business of mattering it has managed to elide the matter of fact itself. And if anyone here tonight has any qualms or doubts about this, please go and ask a still incredulous José Stanio. Himself a bewildered kidnapper for sheer necessity of Kerouac, Sagan, Pynchon, and J.D. Salinger. So of this perception, of this memory of absolute and unquestionable mattering, we happen very arbitrarily to be the unhappy inheritors. Somehow I am reminded of those bleak wintry days when I was 9 or 10 years old and I used to study Maltese civics about the siege of the world and that vicious lampooka that graces our 10-cent coin, while I have the weird hunch that other people in other places were being introduced to Cervantes, to Turner, and so on. So our literary memory, therefore, harks back as far as the sour milk of a jilted homeland goes, to quote Stanley Borch, a milk perhaps even more expired than Paul Celan's black milk of totalitarian ideology. Okay, Vincenzo Consolo speaks about Mediterranean literature and says that one of his distinguishing traits is the captivity of memory, he calls it. So he says that Homer, the etymon of Homer, is a hostage of memory. And likewise, he suggests that Mediterranean literature itself has this powerful connotation of memory, of all that is in our past. It is a captive of memory. And the emergent writer here today is forced into his clandestinity precisely because she is very literally a captive of this unrelenting perception, of this memory of mattering, of this protective fiction, of this psychical facade, this superfeature that bars the way to other narratives, other fantasies and alternative memories. However, Jacqueline Rose also suggests that fantasy is a way of re-elaborating and therefore of partly recognizing the memory, which is struggling against the psychic odds to be heard. A memory that, as Rose puts it, and as we are encountering it today as emergent writers, spells nothing less than a transgenerational haunting. Forms of remembrance, most often hidden and shameful family secrets, which hover in the space between social and psychic history, forcing and making it impossible for the one who unconsciously carries them to make the link. It is this shameful memory, hovering between our social and psychic narratives, between our identification as a nationless state, driven by disparticipation, and a displaced construct of psychic memory, onto the grand récit of nationalism, religion, piety, patriotic complacency, etc., that linger, like a hot but rotten potato, still in our hands. So what is, I believe, desperately wanting in our emergent stance is precisely the elaboration of a discourse of counter-fantasies, hybrid counter-narratives, and most importantly, a literature of counter-memories. This will possibly be an exceedingly risky and daunting undertaking. We are inhabiting that interspace between the decaying past who would not return to us from the land of the dead, and a future that challenges us with an awesome labor of narration. And together with Jacques Derrida, we have to ask, where then are we? And where do we find ourselves as clandestine, as emergent writers? With whom can we still identify in order to affirm our own identity and to tell ourselves our own history? And first of all, to whom do we recount it? Derrida writes, and I feel that this is the predicament of the clandestine writer today, and I think it is very, very almost uncannily, it uncannily ventriloquizes through our condition. One would have to construct oneself anew, writes Derrida. That is, one would have to be able to invent oneself without a model, and without an assured addressee. Here, of course, we have the issue of audience. What about an audience-less literature? What about an audience-less literature that clandestine is facing today, in the stage before it moves into the language of the other? So for the clandestine writer, gazing towards a yet unknowable horizon, to start off without a model is the first inevitable destination. It entails, as a precondition, the shrugging off of the essentialization of Maltese literature as literature with a capital L. Blanchot's opinion in this regard is again indispensable, and for the Maltese clandestine it cannot but come across as the most personal of advice. Blanchot writes that we have to unlearn to behold the I-matter factor of literature. we have to unlearn living the tyrannical visibility of Maltese literature. Our deepest wish as emergent writers has to be not to behold the visibility of the Maltese literature complex that we have inherited, but rather to behold its very invisibility, its sheer non-matteringness. We have to learn not to possess her, quoting Blanchot, in the intimacy of familiar surroundings, but in the unfamiliarity of that which is deprived of intimacy. Not to perpetuate her myth, not to make her live, but to perceive alive in her, and to narrate the very fullness of her death. This is the big Orphic exercise that is necessary if we ever wish to narrate and behold our book to come. The Orphic act of narration will only flourish in the fully-fledged singing of Eurydice's death. I am convinced that a number of clandestine writers have already made much way in terms of realizing this need to perceive the fullness of the death of a perception of Maltese literature as we know it. No more and no less, as it were, than a historical construct of egocentrism, disparticipation, and this need to safeguard our own mediocrity. So attempting to narrate a story of insignificance, disinheritance, and bereavement, and to strategically essentialize this discourse as a distinguishing feature of our emergent writing, requires first and foremost an act of unconditional humility, an act of recognizing our sheer bereavement, our blatant Orphicness, that is both our curse and our infinite blessing. We are precisely living that rarefied space outlined by Derrida, where we have to proceed, yes, both without a model and without an assured addressee. Perhaps Derrida's even more accurate diagnosis of this condition is what he terms an irreducible non-self-identity. Such endeavor would appear to be, using Ivan Kalu's term, quixotic. And it would seem to be quixotic only if we gauge it against the meager efforts conducted so far within the field of Maltese literature. Now I will be outlining some possible traits of an emergent Maltese literature that will be hopefully taken up even by the clandestine writers. And one possible characteristic of our emergent venture would be what I am naming here a negotiatory quality. A salient characteristic within the identification of clandestinity as the very ontological schema of the emergent writer. It is an ambivalent quality. A negotiatory writing will, in Baba's words, make it possible to conceive of the articulation of antagonistic or contradictory elements, a dialectic without the emergence of a teleological or transcendent history. The emergent writer enunciates through a rupture with the homogeneous narrative of the nation and its canon. And from this split in the utterance, from the unbeguiled, belated novelist, emerges an ambivalence in the narration of modern society that repeats, uncounseled and unconsolable, in the midst of the nation's grandiloquence and plenitude. Such a necessary rupture with the Maltese canon that forwards an emergent discourse of antagonism, of contradictoriness and multiple belief, also means that this emergent discourse, us emergent writers, after all, have to tap, first of all, the very etymon of negotiation, or so I believe it is, negozio, negare l'ozio, to shun laziness, refusing to function within the binding perceptions of Maltese literature that linger on today. The emergent clandestine writer will have to be, is already being to an extent, situated within a stance of cultural difference, a stance that, in Homi Baba's words, rearticulates the sum of knowledge from the perspective of the signifying position of the minority that resists totalization. The repetition that will not return as the same, the minus in origin, that is, our Derridean non-self-identity, our invisibility, that then can result, in turn, in political and discursive strategies where adding to does not add up to, but serves to disturb the calculation of power and knowledge and produces other spaces of subaltern signification. The clandestine can narrate their story today precisely by knowing and by being able to speak, in the vein of Foucault and Deleuze, their location of subalternity, of conflict and discourse, even of apparent freakishness and non-matteringness, rather than writing in the radically catacritic mode of seizing the apparatus of canonicity. Having beheld our non-matteringness, having realized that there is no such thing as a proper canonicity, this should definitely not be the target. Although our stance, especially if we envisage ourselves making it into the language of the other, must definitely be antagonistic and aggressive, as Maurice Riordan pointed out, let us also heed Blanchot's words, that the one rule the navigator must obey is to avoid the slightest allusion to a purpose or a destination. Despite the antagonistic and agonistic nature of the venture, we cannot be too blatantly oppositional. We have to listen to Blanchot's warning that a sense of silence, discretion and oblivion is of the essence. The future will have to be there for a writing of negotiation and cultural difference, of shamelessly contradictory sentiments. Walter Benjamin has argued that to write a novel means to carry the incommensurable to extremes in the representation of human life. In the midst of life's fullness, and through the representation of this fullness, the novel gives evidence of the profound perplexity of the living. And what if not perplexity induces the absurd humor of Stanley Borch's persona in his recent short story? And what if not this perplexity informs the protagonist of Giuseppe Stagnol's in Beta Column, unarguably one of the most befuddled characters to be written in Maltese? Whereas Elul Mercer's Lelita Hazzair would nod in resignation were I to draw his attention as to his anti-heroic nature, Stagnol's chap would very likely deal me his trick-or-treat stare and make sure he'd get off with my wife. And only God knows what dirty humor will Borch's character be flaunting on his next excursion. The clandestine writer will have to emerge, therefore, not towards any defined telos, yet surely into somewhere. We will have to emerge into that space in which the narrative of our non-matteringness, or rather our matter-of-factness, as inheritors of an unfortunate inconsequence, will turn our invisibility into an in-visibility. Allow me to clarify this by first quoting an excerpt that articulates the urgency of the need for today's clandestine to attain his invisibility through participation in the language of the other. I am referring to an interesting text written a couple of years ago by Carsten Schwierep. Its ventriloquism into the very position of the clandestine today and its sheer need to make it out there into the language of the other, to narrate his bereavement into the other's language, is almost uncanny. And Schwierep writes, whereto? To the main hall seen by others. To be part of the action, not to be a mere passive viewer. In a world as seen by others, he who cannot see brings his own vision, which has been shaped by his own room. He does not choose his room, but he lives in it. And when he leaves and takes to the landing, the stairs, the hall, the darkness is at the back of his mind, an image that is what he sees and colors what he sees. What better proof than the testimony of a fellow clandestine? Having elicited this crucial condition of the clandestine writer, what is then the inspiration of his emergent writing? I believe that at this stage it is our inspiration is precisely to regard the prospect of a Maltese literature without a thought for art, to regard it with the carelessness and recklessness of a desire oblivious of loss. That is possibly the one hidden law of all inspiration, after all, a careless gaze. Our point of inspiration, that is the moment that makes us precisely clandestini, is the moment when we ask, together with Karsten, where to now? That is also the point of our maximum insecurity. It is a blind leap again, like Orpheus' look towards Eurydice. Blanchot writes that he who is not impatient, and therefore also assertive, will never achieve that other place of clarity, that is the space of narration itself. Impatience must always be the core of infinite patience, he writes, and Maltese literature can move forward, as the current literary bandwagon of Maltese writers is certainly revealing, in a step whose driving force is again what Blanchot very aptly termed the lack of carelessness. So rather than Consolo's condition of our being the captives of memory, I'd rather see us back to our beloved old trade, that of coursers, pirates and thieves, Furbani, using the memory of our captivity as the very condition that enables us to intrude into the languages of others, and from them kidnap our necessary hostages. This need to assert the future of a Maltese literature in the language of the other is a salient concern of a yet unpublished paper by Ivan Kallus, an argument that potentially spells out the last nail in the coffin of Maltese literature as it has been perceived by many hitherto. The most effective way, Kallus writes, for a subaltern literature like the Maltese is to assert itself, is through a presencing in the language of the other. Kallus also anticipates, however, the intervention of that egocentric sentiment that safeguarded the mediocrity that I intimated earlier on. This necessary direction for Maltese writing, Kallus argues, seems a simple truth, but there is no doubt that many will rail against it for reasons which may range from the purportedly patriotic or nationalistic to the puristical. There will be aversion to the notion of anything integrally Maltese being prosthetized by what is foreign. Let us also remind ourselves of a possibility elicited by Callus, that this could all be the start of Maltese literature becoming tempted to write itself immediately in the language of the other, thereby bypassing Maltese completely. We are considering here the serious prospect of what has incidentally already been the itinerary of other subaltern literatures, and I only hope that it will this evening be up for debate, a Maltese literature in English, as that yet slightly obscure virtu of our clandestini. So after all, why not a Maltese literature in English? This entails the recognition, unavoidably Blanchot-esque, that the event of narration set before us is a metamorphosis at all possible levels. It is inherently and irreducibly metamorphic. The time of narration becomes for us another time, not the one prepacked for us by a Maltese canonicity, but the time of the other, in the language of the other. For as Benokri wrote, retorting to Christopher Okigbo's earlier statement that Shakespeare is an African writer, Okri wrote that there are no English writers, there are no African writers, there are good or bad writers, that's all. Allow me finally to make a parallel by way of somehow relating the articulation of clandestine experience to the thorny and very, very contingent issues of clandestinity, immigration, and asylum seeking themselves. I want to refer to Jacques Derrida's essay here on cosmopolitanism and forgiveness, where he reaffirms the belief endorsed by the International Parliament of Writers in a new cosmopolitics, he calls it. This informs, for instance, the belief in the creation of autonomous cities of refuge, as independent of each other and of the state as possible, purposely designed for the hospitality of asylum seekers. Human beings have common possession of the surface of the earth, and Derrida finds Kant's limited endorsement of hospitality as only a right of visitation rather than a right of residence debatable. He invokes the notion of an unconditional hospitality, offering a priori to every other, to all newcomers, whoever they may be. This is a notion that, even as Zizek has argued, will certainly put democracy to the test, especially now, of course, after what's been happening and is still happening today. Perhaps this other idea of cosmopolitanism has not yet arrived, and if it has indeed arrived, perhaps we have not yet recognized it, Derrida writes. The clandestine writing experience will have to, one time or another, give birth to a writing that avails itself of what I am calling a cosmopolitics of writing, where the only restriction and condition would be, as I hope it would be for those who will follow in Popol's steps, the condition of universal hospitality. Spurred ahead by our clandestine narrative, we will make use of the proselytization and the hospitality of the other. Indeed, we will resort to the inherent hospitality of the literary map the world over, and make our own narratives, in turn, hospitable towards others. Unfortunately enough, the cities of refuge for our writing still are much more accessible and possible than the ethic of hospitality, that is, the unquestionable right for the asylum seeker today the world over. Okay. The last very brief notion that I will deal with this evening is that concerning an emergent writing, This emergent writing of the clandestine writers that possibly articulates the thorny issues of clandestinity, immigration, and asylum seeking. I have no qualms about a writing that does articulate the experience of immigrants and asylum seekers. We all know that it's been done. My personal view, however, is that it is very dangerous for a perception of literature to ever take it up to itself as a sort of divine right to articulate, speak about, or speak for immigrants, refugees, and asylum seekers. Narration can only ever narrate itself, and the narration, while it narrates, it enacts what it narrates, is only possible as a narrative if it becomes the event it is narrating. And allow me, having resorted to Blanchot extensively, which is unavoidable given that what we are debating here is writing itself, to apply him one last time with what would be his advice to the clandestine writers. Our relation to the object of our desire, a Maltese literature, whether in Maltese or in the language of the other, can consist of nothing but our narratives themselves. We cannot exist or even be, if not in our narratives and through our narratives. The prospect of a Maltese literature today stands for nothing but this uncanny dependence of us emergent clandestini on our Orphic narratives, of our very matter-of-fact bereavement. If we do not essentialize and narrate this very condition of bereavement itself, we will be again risking being reduced to shadows. Only our narration can make us free, alive and significant within the very rhythms that inform it, and that we have to write into the other's language. And in order to write, we have to be writers in the first place. And we can only write when we have reached that point, which we can only reach in the space to which writing gives access. In other words, to write, as Blanchot writes, we must already be writing. Thank you.
Okay, so, sorry for being late. So Norbert has taken up the issue of how you narrate the experience of being, in a way, a clandestine writer. How do you come out of a tradition which doesn't exist, as I had a copy of his paper, so it's not that I was listening to him from Aura. On the other hand, Popo will be talking about the actual experience of being a refugee, of being literally clandestine or unauthorized or unaccepted. And then after Popo will speak, Popo will make a short introduction about himself, and then he would like to answer our questions about many of the issues that you may be interested in. And then we can go back to Norbert's paper, in which we take up some of the issues that he has been taking up. Of course, the title of this seminar is a very wide-ranging title for those of us who are involved both in the project and in the whole issue of immigration and illegal immigration. So, Mr. Popol Mobetsambila from Congo.
Good evening to everybody. My name is Popol Mobetsambila. I'm from Congo, Republic Democratic of Congo. I was born on 1st of June 1975, and I was a student in my country. I was studying medicine. I did my first year. So when I went to my second year, the war broke out in my country. So I couldn't stay anymore there because of the situation was rolling around my family. That's why I left that country. And I don't know if I would say by lucky or unlucky to be in Malta. I don't know, not yet, but I'm here in Malta. I've asked for seek asylum here in Malta. I've been taking off some times for interview to know exactly my problem, why I left my country. And I've tried to prove them that I was in danger in my country. That's why they have accepted to keep me here in Malta and to give me again the second chance if I can build again my life. That's why I'm here among you here. To answer for any question that anyone will like and will feel to ask, to know about why people they are coming like this, why this emerging in Mediterranean way, I can answer the question that I can feel at all.
Can I just add one thing, that Popol is also an interpreter with the UNHCR. Of course, you come from a country where there are so many languages. We won't even say there are more than 300 languages in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And you act as a translator.
Yeah, for refugees.
So, of course, you can talk about the experience of other refugees that you come in contact with.
Okay. Yeah. Like, personally, talk about me. My father was working with the government, the former government. He was so close to the president. I had a chance with him to travel to different countries in the world. When I had 16 years old, we came in Germany with no more traveling. We came with visa. We stayed for some of time and then we returned back. And then my father said that I was doing well in school. He said that it's better maybe for you to move away to go continue school somewhere else. I went to South Africa to Johannesburg. So lucky, and also they sent my father to work there, like a diplomat for Congo in South Africa. So we stayed together. He was working there. Then the time they gave him to work there was expired. He returned back in Congo. So unfortunately, when we returned back, we came during troubles in the country. So my mother was not from Congo. My mother was not from Congo, was from Rwanda. The country was fighting Congo. So that was a big problem for my family. I was in university for my second year. To my second year, I was in university because I was staying there in university. Then one priest will phone me, say, "I need you." I knew that the country is not in peace. Fire everywhere. I ask, "What is wrong? Is this something wrong?" He say, "No, just stay there. I'm coming there to pick you up." I say, "Okay." I just sat down. He came. He picked me up. And we were going back to my parents' place. He just told me, "Just be a man. Just take courage. Anything you can find at home, don't lose yourself. Just take courage for anything you can find at home." We just reached home like this. First, I found my junior brother, lying down with blood, bleeding blood. I just took my courage and continued going inside the house. And I saw the second one. I saw my junior sister again. And I would see my father near the toilet. He's just doing like this. And I came, the priest told me, "Just don't cry. If you cry, it's not good for you. Just take courage. Maybe let us take them and bring them to the hospital." I said, "But I see like they are dead." He said, "No, they are not dead. Maybe they have chance again to live. Just try to take them. We are going to the hospital." I said, "Where is my mom?" So I entered to the room, one of the room. I saw my mom, like they raped her. And I don't know what they did to her. It was so terrible that I couldn't even look at her again. She was completely dead. So we came back. I tried to shake my father. He was breathing a bit. Check others, my juniors. I mean, they were dead already. So we just tried to took my father, put him in the jeep, bring him to the hospital. And that time, people came back to look for me. They said that one of their son remained. The time we were in the hospital, the priest went, he left me there with my father. He said, "Okay, just wait me, I'm coming." He went back home. And he noticed that they were looking again for me. When he came back to the hospital, he said, "No, I don't know. You can leave me, take care of your father. Better you have to leave this country." I said, "How? And how am I going to leave all these things and no tech with me?" He said, "No, better first is your life. And other things, maybe I'll take care of it. Where you will be, I'll try to send to you." Okay, I said, "Okay, all right, I have to go." I didn't go back to university. I didn't go back anymore at home. Just like I was with the cloth I had. He just put me back in the jeep. He brought me somewhere like bush like this, and he told me, "Just stay here." He tried to negotiate with people to cross me the border, but it was not easy. He tried to give some money. He just said that, no, I need this boy to move away. And still I took my way to arrive here. When I reached Chad, I tried to phone him because I had his telephone number. He just said that on your back, your father dead. But I will try to send you what he left here, anywhere you will be. Just take courage. Maybe you can rebuild again the life of your family, like you stay alive. Just go. And I didn't have a choice. In Sudan, no way to stay there. No family, nothing. I said, "But how can I do?" They send me to United Nations there. Like, they don't want to take care of people there. They say that we have a lot of cases here. People, they are running from the war. So we don't know how we will take care of you again. So some money I had with me, That's when I was running, when the priest let me go, he gave me some money with me. That helped me to continue my journey till to arrive here in Malta. It was not my destiny to come here in Malta. I said, any country will be welcome for me. I will go stay because I don't know what to do. I lost parents. We lost everything. So I'm going, even if I will die, maybe let me die somewhere else. Just let me go. If I will have chance to survive, I will survive somewhere. That's why today I'm here. It was not my, like, person is not, it was not my desire really to come here in Malta. I was good with my parents. I was going to school. And I'm sorry to say that. The position my parents had, I had a car there that even here I cannot drive it here in Malta. I think he saw my little car here I'm driving. It's just to let me move somewhere else. But what I had in my country, I cannot have it here. So it's just the circumstance brought me here. Not that I've dreamed Malta or I've dreamed Europe, something like that. No, for me, Europe was that just come for a visit and go back. For a little way I can talk about me.
Last time we spoke, you told me the story of how you actually arrived in Malta, the last stage of your journey, which was also a very, very difficult and dangerous stage. Mm-hmm. Can you share that story with us? Because it's one of the issues we would like to take up later on when we come to how a person can actually write the story of someone who has gone through such a difficult moment in his life. The last part of the journey.
Yeah, the last part of my journey was that when I reached Sudan, I've tried to ask people that how can I do to go to north? Because I believe that there is a human right in north. Because here in Africa, there is not peace. And Africa is not set down like Europe, I can say. So, like I knew that, I see that, okay, let me try anyway. I can find a way to go to north, that I can find a human right. They can protect me. And I was trying to ask people. Some people would tell me, okay, look, there is a connection that they're helping people to go to north. I say, how? They say, no, it's just not you have a passport with your visa, because you cannot collect a visa. You don't have even a passport, you're there. But there is a connection, they can let you reach north, if just you have your money. I say, okay, how can I do it? They've tried to lead me somewhere. This traffic of clandestine is really a big traffic. It's not a small thing. They are big people, they are doing that. It's not just somebody just maybe taking a piece of wood and put people and push them. No, it's a big connection. Which maybe to stop it, it will ask too much. They brought me somewhere and they just say, okay, just sit down there. I sat down and some luxury car will come, just okay. Is this the person? How many are here? I say, okay, we have collect 20 people here. I say, okay, they've got all of their money? I say, yes, yes. I think everyone got this $1,000? It's okay, yes, yes, yes. Okay, one responsible is there. Collect all the money, put the name down. The night, the truck will come. And the operation is making very quick. When the truck will come, it's not taking long day. Just the truck will come, people just entering, getting, lock it straight to the sea. Come to the sea and the boat is there, everything is prepared. They just bring and look around. They have people for security. They're making the security. holding guns, is really organized. And they put people in the boat, they look, and they used to check the weather, if it's acceptable that these people can cross the sea. Sometimes they can see that we don't care, because if we try to move back these people, it's wrong. Just let them go. If they will go die, they are not lucky. And they will just put people like that. And I had opportunity to that way. They put me inside. We were something like 30 people, 32 or 33. They say, okay, this destination, normally when the boat is moving on, they don't have a country. They are going. They just move on the boat like that. And those even there, they are trying, if I would say they are captain or what. I don't know if they used to fish or what, they just going like that. With many, many risks. They are just trying like that. We went to reach to Turkey. Reach Turkey. They tried to look around, they said, no. This is not where we can drop. Human right is not here. We have to turn the boat quickly. And they have people there. They call them, they come, they collect us from the port sea, they brought us to hide us somewhere. They had some people there with them. They have prepared before. They put all of us to one big boat it was not a really big boat. It was like 17 meters, I think so, yes. With 230 people inside. And we were traveling like sardine, you know, like they used to put sardine, you know, just like that. And we don't have choice. We have to move on. And coming, we did most 16 days on the sea. 16 days on the sea. Food finished. Water finished. And we try even just to take again water from the sea. But we couldn't drink it. And children, they are crying. They need water. And we try, we say, okay, anyway, we just pray for that water. We get children like that. And they start sick, making diarrhea, and they mess the boat. No way. And when we are coming, we reach on somewhere on the sea. We saw again one boat was coming, like from Libya. Again, one boat was coming, and the captain started trying to stop them. They said that we are not finding the way. They say, okay, what can we do? Even this boat coming from Libya is not able to reach north. We are going to put some again to your side. Because we are afraid even to kill these people here. We are giving you some people. They took again most like, I think, around 30 or 40 again. They add again. I'm telling you, it was terrible. Like, I reach now today. If even Malta doesn't want me, they return me back to Africa, I would prefer to die for any accident there than to risk the way I risk on the sea. I cannot accept it again. Because I saw the death. Everybody was just praying, say, God, you know we didn't want to take this way. But because of the problem, just keep us safe to reach where we can reach. Any country. We don't choose a country, any country. I had one friend when we reached here. We just met on the journey. On the port sea when we're coming. That guy, when we reached here in Malta, he couldn't stand up again straight. I'm sorry to tell. It looks like he blocked himself like this. Because since he sat down like this for 16 days, he couldn't move a bit inside the boat. So what's happened. He was like blocked like this. He couldn't stand up again straight. And they brought him in the hospital with the main operation, something like that. I don't know what about him, because since I came out from the detention, it was just for my case, I came out, I don't know about others, and I don't know about that one. And what is the, I don't know, till now. So it's a condition that people are traveling, it's not safe, and it's not preferable. And we are not accepted like that, but no way. If Africa was set down, I don't think that you can receive people coming anyhow. And I'm trying to let you know, a lot of people are still preparing to cross that way the sea. A lot of people are still preparing. Anyhow, you can send that message, say that because I'm working here, like they choose me like a president for the community of Congo. And I used to try to phone even people, to phone some Congo that's maybe in North Africa, Libya or what. They're trying to tell me that, tell people the situation like his, to stop them. But when you're talking to people, sometimes they insult me before. They say, who are you? You reach there and you want us to die in Africa? I say, anyway, good luck. You can try to explain to them the condition of the road. They are not accepted. They just said, we will come. If we will die, that was our time. If we will arrive safe, it's the will of God. Just leave us, do it. I just say, turn a hand, good luck.
Michael Gregg.
Hi. Are there any European or American governments or businesses behind the warring parties in Congo and in the other wars that unknown to us are going on throughout Africa?
Yes, there's one point that I used to, even last time, 2 weeks ago, I was discussing a bit with the director of United Nations here in Malta. He called me, wanted to ask me some question, because there are some people even that have been given some protection here in Malta, but their cases has been rejected. So they gave them a temporary staying in Malta. But like they were not satisfied, they've moved on, go to other countries around the Europe, but they are feeling to come back again to Malta. So some of them used to phone me, say, Popo, we need to come back. I say, why? They said, no way. Like, we have been rejected from Malta. We are afraid to ask another seek asylum here. Like, Malta is going to join the European Union. So if they notice that, okay, we come again here to another country to ask seek asylum, they return us back to Malta. So we don't know what the end is going to be. I went to see the director, discussed a bit with him. So I tried to tell him the point that this question came from. He told me that the point is so difficult, we don't know what can we do. I say yes, but the problem is that, I'm sorry to tell you, director, is you, European, you are causing problem in Africa. You say, how? I say yes. The war in Africa, political problem, economical problem, is European, they are causing that. We knew that. We are learning it from even from university. That's, you will see in the country, like talking about Congo. The countries divide most, I can say, on three pieces. I can stand up, say that I want to set free this country, to bring everything cool and bring good situation for the population. It's a good idea. But to bring that peace, you need to fight. Because this one is in the power, we not give him like gift like this. Let's protect the country. And behind that person, you will see one of the country of Europe is in the back of that person, of a leader of the war. And you will see another one, such countries in the behind him. The third one, such countries behind him. And they will give enough weapon to fight. Sometimes you ask questions, but
Where you collect all these weapons to fight like this? And later on, you find plane coming down to his side where it's occupied the area. Like a region he occupied, you see planes coming down from the country supporting him. But they are doing it on a secret way. And you see, they are killing the population. They are killing innocent. And that's why sometimes they are feeling not to stay in the country. And some of the, like one of the examples happened, I can give you, like say, I've seen a small baby, maybe 3 or 4 months. A small baby, because just they are feeling to win the country, and they feel wicked, and they took the small baby here like this, and knock him on the tree, and all the brain out, just because they are hungry to win the war. They will take a woman during the war like this, and they find you like this, and you're not to their side. It's just between us. But I'm support from such countries, support from some country. And we are fighting this, okay, when I win, I know what I'll do with this country. They will take a woman and off the clothes, take a stick and put in the private place. They will put till the stick will come out like this. And they put it like this. There are some of the things that you cannot say. And you will not resist to stay. You just feel to go away. So to answer to your question, that I'm sorry to say that. I'm not saying that it's you sit down here, you doing that. But we know that Europeans, they are causing problems in Africa. And behind that, they need some natural resources. They'll be collecting. We used to see how planes used to fly before these things. They will collect, they will do anything they want. They collect them. They fly just going, and people, they are dying for that. You know, saying they're dying, things like that. And they can come like this, and like they took a hostage in the house, and soldier will come. The parents, they are there with their children. They can say to the boy, hey, come, off your blood. And the boy will off, they tell the mom, off your cloth. I sleep here. And you, come with this woman. You can, if you resist the kill. And they say, hey, come on. Doing that, then they're laughing, you do it, when you finish, and then finish, they kill you. So such kind of things. It's not happy to see that. That's, I can say, a piece of, a bit of reason that people, they are running away. There are some of the people, really, they are running because of economical problem, nothing to eat, suffering, you know. So they're trying, maybe they can find a way to live to north. All these problems is what is causing this emerging of coming here.
You have listened to the first part of Articulating the Clandestine Experience. This seminar was part of the Work in Progress seminars. You will listen to the second part of this seminar next week. You have listened to Work in Progress, a series of seminars on understanding cultural diversity.
Thank you.